Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host, NBC legal and political analyst, Dean Johnson. The statewide pandemic moratorium on evictions due to residential non-payment of rent has ended for some. Others are still protected. COVID rental assistance is still pending for one group, but no more applications will be accepted. Just where are we? Dean?
Good evening, everyone. You know, tonight we're going to return to one of our most popular subjects, landlord-tenant law. With the lessening of the pandemic, has the state withdrawn from the landlord-tenant arena, or are rent moratoria here to stay? And with more and more cities and counties enacting some form of rent control and a state tenants' rights law in effect now, as it has been for many months, are we looking at statewide rent control on a permanent basis? Jeff?
Joining us tonight, for some 20 years, San Francisco landlord-tenant attorney Jessica Chilek represents clients in rent board actions, mediations, and court for landlord-tenant issues. Jessica launched her practice to specialize in San Francisco residential evictions, vacancy agreements, and rent board petitions for tenants, landlords, master tenants, and subtenants.
And also joining us tonight, San Mateo attorney David Finkelstein. David is a graduate of NYU Law School and is admitted to practice in the states of California and New York. He began his career as a staff attorney in California for the National Housing Law Project at Bolt Hall Law School. David has been representing clients in real estate and landlord-tenant matters for some 40 years, and David has published articles about protection for renters during the COVID-19 crisis.
Also joining us tonight is San Francisco attorney Salvatore Timpano. Sal is considered one of the top attorneys in the Bay Area to practice in the area of landlord-tenant law, representing both landlords and tenants in the area of eviction. Sal, David, Jessica, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Nice to be here.
Before we start taking calls and before we really start a lot of question and answers, I wanted to give you a chance to talk to us a little bit about where we are when we talk about the statewide pandemic moratorium on evictions. And we've all heard a lot about that over the last 2 years. Seems like things are really changing.
Yes, Jeff, they are, actually. During the pandemic, the state enacted a moratorium on evictions due to rent debt that was related to COVID-related financial distress. It was only about non-payment of rent, and it had to be specifically due to COVID-related financial distress. But the deadline for the applications for the rent relief program passed at the end of March. And the time for the payments to be made to landlords and tenants who applied has been extended to June, but they're not accepting new applications at this time.
Okay, we've been advising our landlord clients not to pursue evictions for rent before March 31 of this year because of the requirements of the various state and local municipalities. And although you can still go to small claims court for the money if you haven't been paid from applying for Housing is Key, but we advise our landlords only to file evictions for rent owing after March 31st, so from April 1 on.
David, we're sort of doing the same thing. We've been pretty successful in getting tenants to apply prior to the March 31st deadline. Many of them applied on the very last day, but they didn't understand. And so in speaking with them, I was able to get a significant amount of tenants to apply for that. And now we're in the process of seeing if they're going to be eligible because they either have to qualify or there have to be enough funds available for all these tenants. If one of those don't work, then the landlords can initiate eviction proceedings as soon as that's been determined. Otherwise, they'll have to wait until the end of June, if that's how long it takes, for the determination of eligibility to be made for the tenants that did apply before March 31st. For the ones that didn't apply, landlords can begin eviction proceedings anytime. There's no moratorium for non-payment of rent cases due to COVID hardships for tenants that did not apply by March 31st. It's a shame for those tenants if they didn't know about it.
Right, but you had to give them, I think, a 15-day notice to didn't you have to give them 15 days to a notice to apply?
It's not just a 3-day notice at this point. That's right. And what were you going to say, Jessica? You were going
to
add in?
I was going to say that, yes, there were notices that the state required landlords to serve in February 2021 and afterward about giving notice to the tenants that this process was available through the end of March of 2022.
Just as a little background, you all mentioned the 3-day notice, which was the famous deadline for a landlord notifying tenants that they were going to seek eviction. That's changed now. I mean, there's several different types of notice that landlords have to give to tenants before eviction proceedings start. Yes?
That's right, Dean. The first big change came before the pandemic, and the notice used to count 3 calendar days. The big change that came to it after a very long time was that you can no longer count calendar days, they've got to be business days. So Saturdays and Sundays don't count. So the landlord who would serve on a Friday and box the tenant into having to seek assistance on Monday, that landlord can't do that anymore. They've got to get a bona fide amount of time, the tenants now, in order to, you know, they got to get their full 3 days. So weekends and holidays don't count anymore.
Right.
And so that was the first big change. That was before COVID. Then there were a bunch of changes that came in after COVID. I could see Jessica's ready to give us one or two of those.
Oh, I was just going to comment that the change to the 3-day notice, not including weekends and holidays, is part of the Tenant Rights Act of 2019. And that's what introduced statewide rent control and eviction controls. And then, yes, during COVID, we've had a lot of changes to the various notices. The key now is that it's for COVID-related rent debt, it's a 15-day notice to pay or quit.
In certain municipalities, like San Francisco has just imposed an extra 10-day warning letter, but there's a lawsuit that was filed and there's a stay of that. And I was informed this morning that there's a hearing on that lawsuit scheduled for this Friday, May 27th, to determine if the stay is going to stay in place. But in San Francisco, I believe the best way to go would be to give the warning letter at least until that ruling is made. And then in Alameda County, there's a moratorium right now, and it's being challenged. But, I mean, you could still serve a 3-day notice, but you can't file or evict anyone because of the moratorium.
One of the things that jumped out to me from what you've been saying about this deadline for March 31st seems to me that for tenants, for a lot of them, there'd be a real incentive to apply knowing they were ineligible just because it would freeze any action from a landlord. Is there any recourse for a landlord if the tenant hasn't paid the rent, filed in order to freeze out any evictions until it plays out, and maybe buy themselves 2-3 months additional?
That's what we're recommending to most of our landlord clients, that they not sue for for pre-April rent.
So you've all mentioned this March 31st deadline. After March 31st, are rent moratoria just dead? Is that the drop dead date, or are we looking at possible extensions or even returns to moratoria?
Well, the moratorium on COVID-related non-payment of rent eviction cases basically ended, and the state had provided the Housing is Key rent relief program, and the rent application deadline was March 31st. It was originally the deadline for payouts also, but as that was looming and a lot of landlords and tenant agencies were saying, you know, payments hadn't been made, you know, the legislature extended the payout date through June 30th.
As you can see, there's a lot to discuss. Here's your opportunity to get in on the conversation, to call up, to ask us your questions. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our attorney guests can't provide you precise legal advice without all the facts relating to your given case, but we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist in your decision-making, and know that our guests are providing you guidance that may not be the positions of their employers or their clients, but they're here to help. Our phone number again is 415-841-4134 or 866-798-8255. Has the state started taking steps to get out of the arena, the eviction moratorium arena?
Well, that's an interesting question, Jeff. The law that is extending the moratorium for non-payment of rent due to COVID, it's Assembly Bill 2179. It also prevents localities from initiating any moratorium during the time between April 1st and June 30th. So the state is running the show right now. On July 1st, under the current assembly bill, local governments can begin to enact their own moratoriums. Maybe the state will do something then. I don't know. Maybe Dave or Jessica might know, but I haven't heard of anything that the state is planning to do after this moratorium expires on June 30th.
Well, you know, we're all kind of breathing a sigh of relief that COVID has lessened or we've learned to live with it. But is there a real possibility that moratoria could become a permanent feature in some states but cities, counties? And is there a possibility that if, say, a new variant comes along or monkeypox becomes the next pandemic, that we could be looking at yet more moratoria in the future?
Personally, I don't think it's going to hold up constitutionally unless they also extend the Housing is Key or some similar program to relieve the landlord of the rent debt, because otherwise, most of my landlord clients are mom and pops or small numbers of units owned by families, and how are they going to end up paying the mortgage, the taxes, the insurance, the upkeep, if they can't get the rent indefinitely? It's definitely an unconstitutional taking unless they can get the rent from some governmental entity. That's my outlook on it.
Two comments to David. One of them regarding the with a statewide moratorium continuing that Dean asked about, we're still under a COVID 2019 state of emergency that Governor Newsom declared. And so he has his powers under that to declare other moratoria should things get bad again. But he has indicated that he wants to move out of that kind of paranoid or reactionary thinking into, you know, more of an COVID being endemic. If monkeypox becomes something else, then there might be a state of emergency based on that. But David, you were asking, you know, what about relief for the landlords? Currently going through the legislature is SB 847. I understand that it is designed to help landlords obtain relief if they weren't able to get relief under the Housing is Key program. It's still working its way through. It hasn't been approved. So it's not in place yet, but it's out there as a possible way for the state to help landlords who didn't get help under Housing is Key for whatever reason.
I just want to add one thing to that real quickly. Landlords can still sue either in small claims court or superior court for unpaid rent, which is something they could have done pre-pandemic as well. So they can't get possession of the unit through those avenues, but they can seek their damages for non-payment of rent. That was before the pandemic, and it's they can do it now as well.
Let me turn it to Andrew.
If you're not looking.
Let me turn it over to Andrew from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about, San Francisco is where I'm from, and whether there's been any talk of moratorium barring evictions for things other than non-payment of rent, so no-fault evictions such as owner move-ins and that type of thing.
I'm not aware of any. I'm not aware of any moratorium for that. That would go into effect after the state moratorium ends at the end of June. That doesn't mean that it won't happen. We still have a bit of time, but I don't know of anything that's already in place.
Sal, have you heard of anything in that regard?
There were moratoriums on Ellis Act evictions. On just any kind of no-fault evictions at one point. I don't know if they still exist.
Not currently.
Not currently, yeah. So they're not there. It's winding down. The moratoriums seem to be winding down. And so.
I see. And generally, how long before the expiration of a moratorium would a municipality need to act in order to, you know, create a new law barring an eviction?
So right now, under the current assembly bill that's in effect, municipalities can start preparing now for something to be enacted on July 1st, when the current moratorium and statewide prohibition against localities issuing their own moratoriums expires. So localities can begin the process now. Their scheme won't take effect until July 1st, 2022. I imagine that San Francisco will probably they're going to have something ready to go for July 1st.
My immediate sense is to presume that the city can move a whole lot faster than the state can. Is that your experience as well, Jessica?
Yes and no. Some of the city council or San Francisco rent board hearings can be very contentious and have a lot of people who wish to speak. So yes and no, they can move a little bit faster. The state has already, there's at least the SB 847 and potentially coming in place to help landlords. It's possible. I mean, as we were moving up on the application and moratorium deadline on March 31st, the legislature moved pretty quickly to at least extend the time for payment. But, it's hard to say.
Hasn't the mayor in San Francisco issued her own stays by mayor's decree?
Yes, the mayor has done it. A lot of stays. Can't do it now because of the assembly bill, but the San Francisco mayor's been doing a lot of that. And that's why I think in, you know, come July 1st, either by, you know, supervisors or mayors or rent board, but that there's some, I imagine there'll be something in place, especially if the pandemic doesn't, you know, well, it's not even just the, it's not just the way the pandemic's going, but the lasting effects that it may have already caused. So the pandemic may be winding down, but tenants are still in financial hardship. So, you know, the local governments are going to take account of that. And it won't matter if the pandemic's winding down necessarily.
Landlords, too. They need assistance as well. The mom and pop types. I don't know about the corporate ones. But at least the mom and pop types.
Sure.
Andrew, I hope we've answered your questions.
Yeah, that was very helpful. Thank you all for your input on that.
Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. So we talked a little bit about the state kind of backing away from the whole idea of eviction moratoriums and how it's possible that some of the local areas will step up. The other area that we see the state in some ways re-engaging, but in some ways drawing in the localities, is in rent control. And it seems that some of the local cities and towns have enacted some sort of rent control in the last several months, maybe a year. There's two of them coming online that I'm aware of in Marin where it didn't exist, and some others are making noises. What can you tell us about those?
I do know that it's been a trend over the 20 years or so that I've been practicing for more and more cities to enact rent control, for localities to enact rent control. When I first started practicing, I think there were 14, and the last time I checked, there were over 30. So, and you know, so that, you know, and you just mentioned two more. So that's possible. Local areas may have their own rent control. If not, then it defaults to the statewide rent control that was enacted in 2019.
Right. Well, the statewide rent control is, you know, even from a landlord's point of view, pretty generous. It's usually the cost of living plus 5%, but the governor's pandemic restriction that you can't have over more than 10% in any case. So I believe that's a state limit that you can't have more than 10%. But I recently was asked to research in Mountain View, and I think Mountain View has a very restrictive increased, limited to about 2%, which seems going the other way when you have over 6% inflation and they limit the increase to 2%. I'm questioning the enforceability of that, but apparently it's still in a force and effect.
Right. Well, I mean, I know landlords are still entitled to get a return on investment. It just depends, I guess, how that works. The 2% versus 6% doesn't seem to balance the sheet, you know?
No, and that goes to the constitutional taking that you were talking about earlier, David. You know, it's the landlords are in the business of providing housing. And if the state wants them to continue to be in that business, the landlords have to be able to earn an investment grade return. Otherwise, they'll put their money elsewhere. And then, you know, the state can become the landlord for everybody. And I don't think the state's interested in doing that. And probably wouldn't be good for the tenants in the long run anyway.
Isn't this rent control seems to me to be a bad application of economics. I mean, you know, economics 101, supply and demand, if you put a restriction on a price, an artificial restriction, then the supply is just going to go down, which seems to be self-defeating. When the supply goes down, the price goes up, and the availability of reasonable cost housing is thereby reduced, which exacerbates what may be the major problem in our housing market today. Am I wrong about that, or am I right?
In general, I agree with you, Dean. What's been done in the past is that, San Francisco anyway, will not apply rent control to new construction, and it won't apply for a certain period of time. The original Rent Control Act only went rent control San Francisco rent control only applied to properties built prior to a date in 1979. So everything from 1980 forward is outside of rent control. So those new constructions wouldn't be discouraged because of rent control. But in general, yeah, rent control would discourage builders from taking on big projects because investors may not be interested if they know they're going to be restricted on their rent control. The statewide rent control excludes properties that are brand new for 15 years. So anything built will be out of the statewide rent control scheme for 15 years. After that, they're in the rent control scheme. So at 15 years, I guess, has been decided. Oh, go ahead, Jessica.
I was going to say, I just wanted to note that it's a rolling 15 years. So it's 15 years back from whatever date we're at now.
From the date of construction, right?
No, from where we are now, it rolls back. The 15 years from today going back is exempt from the rent control. And then, next month, it'll be 15 years from next month's date back.
Right. So in other words, if a residential property is built 5 years from now, are you saying it gets its 15 years to be out of rent control?
Right.
Yes. Okay. That's what I thought you were saying. And I agree.
Right. And the other thing is the Costa-Hawkins Act, which has been part of California law for quite a while now, it outlawed a concept called vacancy control. When I first started law school, I worked for a man in Berkeley who did rent control work in Berkeley, and at the time, Berkeley had vacancy control, which meant that Berkeley set the rents, and then made whatever the rents were, that was it. And if a tenant left, if the unit was vacant, the city was still setting the rents, so it was controlled at time of vacancy. And Costa-Hawkins eliminated that. It said that when a unit is vacant, it should go to market rate. So that was there to help the landlords as well.
Yeah, and that does help the landlords, and it does provide for what Dean was talking about earlier, supply and demand. You know, that vacant unit is now up at market rent. It's part of what, it's part of the supply, and it's put out there at market. So
that only applies either to a single family unit or a duplex in which the owner lives in one of the units, but otherwise it doesn't apply to multi.
Yeah, it strikes me that the whole idea of rent control has a lot of unintended consequences behind it. I mean, people who own older buildings may tear down the building and put up a newer building just to avoid rent control. Families who have children grow up and leave will hang on to the family dwelling rather than moving into a smaller apartment. I mean, the consequences seem to go on and on.
I agree with you, Dean. There's a lot of those, shenanigans taken advantage of. There's a lot of that going on, and it's all created. And it's not just rent control, but when laws, seek to restrict a group of people, then people will look for ways around it, and they try to find legitimate ways, and they might even, use illegitimate means. But yeah, the rent ordinance is one of those where landlords and tenants We'll look for ways to, you know, not be oppressed, you know, by the law if it's affecting them that way. I agree with you. I agree. I don't know if Jessica and David agree, but I agree that, you know, it gives me a lot of work. The rent ordinance does.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. With me tonight is Dean Johnson. The state's in many ways taken a step back from the eviction arena. Where do landlords and tenants stand today? Tonight's guests, David Finkelstein, Sal Timpano, and Jessica Chilek, are among the best landlord-tenant attorneys in the region. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on landlord-tenant law. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation, and neither is Robert. Robert from San Francisco, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you very much. My rent wasn't raised in 2020, and it wasn't, you know, my annual increase, and it wasn't raised in 21, and it hasn't been raised in 22. Am I going to have to pay that?
Well,
possibly. It was in 2020. There was a stay of rent increases. The landlords were prohibited from serving rent increases. But after that, in 2021, they could serve that rent increase, you know, banked for 2020, 2021, and 2022. Those would all be banked. Jessica, looks like she has something to add to that.
I just wanted to mention that there is the San Francisco Rent Board has now set up and authorized a registry of residential rental properties, and landlords are not allowed to do rent increases or even annual increases until they've registered their properties. So that may also be holding up your rent increase.
How does those banking rules apply as versus the Governor Newsom's the overall restriction during the pandemic of not going over 10%?
So I haven't had any banked increases that went over 10%, you know, during this pandemic. But I'll venture a guess that in San Francisco, you can bank your increases. There's no limit, but if there's a statewide limit, they might get capped there, by the state. But otherwise, if it's 20 years, you bank them for 20 years, and then the state, you know, laws will apply. If it's over 10%, you got to give longer notice period for that rent increase to take effect. So there's always a play, you know, between the state and the local San Francisco rent increase rules at play. If you're over 10% or over,
strategically so. Too, the landlords could, you know, take their earliest banked rent increases up to 10%, and then the next year do the next set of banks up to 10%. You know, and just do that if they've got several years of bank increases that are pushing the limit.
That's what I probably would recommend to my landlord clients to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree, David. It just gets you out and gets you out of the, you know, potentially prevents you from losing the banked increases as well, where there's a rank, you know, something like in San Francisco, because the landlords can lose the, you know, portions of their banked rent increases if they don't do it properly. So that suggestion is probably the best way, you know, to do it. And they're entitled to that. And I don't think I've ever had a tenant complain about a bank rent increase being applied. I don't think I've ever came across that.
Robert, I hope that answers your question.
Yes, you guys. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us. And let me turn it to Gina. Gina from Oakland, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there. I definitely don't want to come off as hostile, but my frustration as a renter in Oakland goes out to the way this subject is being discussed. Sounds to me like everyone on the call probably owns their own home. I'm a nonprofit worker. I've lived in the Bay Area for 22 years. The idea of purchasing a home is next to impossible. I am a renter and probably will be a renter for the rest of my life. And when we talk about rent increases of 6, 7, 10%, that is real life increase. That is a real fiscal problem for many of us that are living in marginally middle class existences. So to me, we're talking about this as a way for landlords to make or break, but we're not talking about this in terms of real life situations when it comes to housing in the Bay Area. And I mean housing as in where I live, where I lay my head, and the safety of that. If rent goes up 10% or 6.7%, which Oakland is proposing, and then they can back charge us up to a one time of 10%, that means it outpaces even the inflation that we're dealing with. And while inflation is being told at 6%, we're actually paying more like 8 to 8.2% inflation. So it feels personal. and I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina. And I appreciate your perspective. And I'm going to turn it over to my guests in a moment. But the other side of that is that if the landlords can't, in some measure, pass on some of their increased costs, you create a great disincentive, it seems, to do the normal maintenance and upkeep that's required. And their costs have gone through the roof, too. How do you strike a balance so that, on the one hand, the landlords are keeping up the properties and Gina's not living in squalor, and yet at the same time, her rent's not going up so high as to push her out the door? How do you balance those interests?
Jeff, the rent ordinance in San Francisco, you know, everybody behind it, landlords, tenants, you know, the landlords and tenants are on the board of the rent board. And, you know, they've been trying to do that for a long, long time. San Francisco is subject to the world economy. You know, if there's inflation, it's going to get us too, you know, and the landlord's costs are current costs. When they're paying for a plumber, they're paying 2022 rates. They're not paying 2019 rates or 1987 rates. Yet the rent control is steeping the tenancy, the rent, you know, back to its inception date with very, you know, with controlled rent increases. But those same controls do not apply to third-party vendors that landlords need in order to upkeep the property. So it's, I understand Gina's problem. I understand the personal, you know, attack that, you know, hearing rent increase, just those words, you know, they feel like an attack. But I see the landlord's plight as well. Where the answer is, maybe David or Jessica will have something to say about it. But I don't know where the answer lies. There's always going to be some friction there.
You know, I don't know if we have an answer right now. Gina, I do completely sympathize with you. I am not a homeowner and probably never will be either, for whatever reasons. But, you know, and it is very scary to hear rent increase. At this point, I think it's in measures to bring up minimum wage so that it's actually a living wage the way it was meant to be. when it was first enacted. Maybe it is building more housing and, you know, trying to, I know there's a lot of issues around building more housing. There's a lot of folks who don't want their neighborhoods to change, but there have been some moves in that regard. The state legislature is trying to allow multiple units on single family lots or, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, there's work that needs to be done, and I'm not sure it's at the local level. It may be, it may not be.
Yeah, you know, I always like to talk about the elephant in the room. And I think the elephant here is that maybe rent control as a concept is just ill-conceived for a lot of reasons. And that there are other solutions, as Jessica said, potential subsidies for renters, poor middle class, even in our area, upper middle class renters could use those subsidies. Creation of public housing, good public housing that people can enjoy and live in, you know, at people even with a reasonable income. I mean, there's no question we have a massive housing crisis in the Bay Area. And in some ways, it's a product of our success. But I think maybe the solutions are not the solutions that we're pursuing right now.
You know, I remember graduating law school, and yeah. As any professional, you graduate school, you often have a lot of loans. And I remember seeing how there was loan forgiveness, both from lenders and from government, for people that went into certain fields, particularly nonprofits, particularly charitable endeavors, those that you're not going to make the money, but they'll help you with your loans, help you get through stuff. And it seems to me that we may be working toward a solution like that, where somebody like Gina, who's doing good work for nonprofits and is really trying to help make the world a better place, maybe there's a special subsidy that we should be looking at, that the government should consider for folks like her, so that she's not having to choose between going into a more commercial environment or paying her rent.
Down here on the peninsula, I have seen something that, you know, it's obviously there's no one single answer, but like, for example, in Redwood City, I've seen the government actually encouraging owners to apply to have even not only ADUs, which is an accessory dwelling unit in the backyard, but forget about that. They're actually encouraging and fast-tracking conversion of garages in like Redwood City into an ADU. Which they always used to, I used to have defend owners from evictions or red tagging, but now they're actually encouraging them with a minimal amount of money to convert their garage into an ADU and allow lower income affordable housing. And, you know, I think that's one possible solution among many.
Let me turn it over to Deborah from San Francisco. Deborah, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I'm really glad you're talking about rent control and all that tonight. I've been waiting for this to come up again. Anyway, so my situation is I've been living in my unit for 16 years. I'm a personal friend of the owner. I've known her for 50 years. She's never raised my rent, which is really nice because we're really good friends. But she will be selling the building in the next year or so. So I added up all the rent increases that I didn't pay for, and it comes to 26 or 27%, something like that. So that's a bit of an owie, considering I'm coming up on 74 years old. And So I heard you say earlier that they'll bank it, possibly bank it in increments. And so I'll just have to deal with that. So can I be evicted, number one, for like a move-in? And then I also have the only garage in the building, which is not on my lease, which I do not pay for, but which I have used the entire time I've been here. Another perk of being a good friend. So what do you think?
I'm just confirming, you're in San Francisco?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, when a housing service such as a garage is been provided for at least a year, it becomes part of the rental agreement. So you okay. do have some rights in that housing. And when your landlord is getting ready to sell, one of the things that the real estate agent will provide to you is a estoppel certificate or a request for information under a particular rent board ordinance that allows for collection of information that will be provided to potential buyers. And
okay.
In those documents, you can put in that you have rights to use the garage and things like that.
Okay.
As far as the rent increases go, you may want to work with the landlady, your friend the landlady, on doing some of that before any sale, so that you don't have a new owner who wants to impose it all at once.
Okay.
Or something like that. Or, and it would also make it more attractive to a buyer to have current rents and not things that, they're going to think your rent is very low,
Of course. Okay. And how about a relative move in or eviction or how I've been here for 16 years. I'm well over 65. And what's the thing with that as far as you know?
Well, owner and relative move-ins are allowed both under the San Francisco Rent Ordinance and under the state rent control and eviction control laws. But different areas have different requirements. The owner has to own at least 25%. An owner move-in, the person would have to move in San Francisco, would have to move in within 2 months and have stay for 36 consecutive months. There's relocation payments that the rent board specifies. There's a lot going on with them. They're complex, and there's a lot of reporting afterward as well that so the owner may not want to take on.
Yeah. So the owner could move in, but then they'd have to stay for a prescribed amount of time. I mean, I understand that. Can you run that by me again, please, as far as a relative or an owner moving in?
Right. An owner move in San Francisco, they have to give you the required amount of notice and half of the relocation fee at the time of the notice. Then when you leave, they have to give you the remainder of the notice, the remainder of the relocation fee. And the person has to move in within 2 months, and they have to stay at least 36 consecutive months, and they have annual reporting that they have to file with the rent board as to, whether they're still living there or not for up to 5 years afterward.
And so I wouldn't know if they were living here or not, right? They could just keep it vacant for that amount of time and...
No, they have to
Go ahead, Jessica. Sorry.
I was going to say under the local ordinance, they have to actually move in and live there. The reason they can evict for her owner move in is so that they can live there. The state law recognizes the owner's right to live in the place they own.
This building has 13 units in it.
Mm-hmm.
They're all small, 525 square foot units.
Doesn't seem like a very good candidate for an owner move-in.
No, it doesn't. No. Not really. I've been happy living here as a single person. It's worked really well for me. My place is adorable. I'm in the Upper Haight. It's really nice. Corner unit. It's perfect, actually. Yeah, I definitely don't want to leave. Okay.
Yeah.
So when it gets close to selling, I should ask my landlord to raise the rent, like have a new lease and raise the rent a certain amount, and would that eliminate all the other years that she didn't bank? Is that how that would work?
No, I mean the new owner would be able to take whatever rent increases that your landlord didn't. But I just thought maybe, you know, if you worked with your landlord to do a bit more beforehand, it would lessen any blow when a new owner takes over.
Okay.
Yeah, so, that's a suggestion to consider. But you would be paying increased rent sooner because you would be paying that increased rent under your current landlord who might not otherwise raise your rent. So just something for you to consider.
Yeah, I've definitely been doing a lot of
considering
about all of this. Yeah, definitely, you know.
Yeah.
You know, being a retired school teacher and all that, it is what it is. But, okay.
And, you know, just
really
one last thing. I know our time is limited here, but if you do get a very big rent increase, you can always make a petition, you know, file a petition with the rent board. You know, it's called a hardship petition and see if they can, you know, intercede and, you know, and help you with the rent. It, you know, you have to be eligible for what you're asking for, but there are petitions you can file if you meet the eligibility requirements that would, you know, help you not get, you know, evicted because the rent went up too high too fast.
Yeah. I've been sort of like bracing for that, but I mean, it hasn't happened yet. She actually had the building for sale over COVID, which was a little ridiculous because in lockdown you couldn't show the building.
Mm-hmm.
And then she just kept the sign up. And I think the building went, you know, in real estate terms, they call it going stale. You know, the sign was up, and of course it wasn't selling. And so she took it off the market, but, you know, eventually she'll put it back on again. I know that.
Yeah.
Which is her right. I mean, she's owned it for, you know, 37 years or something like that. But anyway. Okay. You know what? I really appreciate KALW, a member. I listen to it all the time, and I love your call an attorney and all that. I love that. That's, like, perfect for everybody.
Deborah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I hope we've been of help, and I really appreciate your ending with that note. That makes me feel good about what we're doing. Let me jump over to Michelle from Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
You're on the air. We hear you fine, loud and clear.
Great. Well, I just want to respond. I'm sorry. I haven't listened to the whole show. I'll go back and see if I can get a tape of it. But I kind of tuned in when someone was shortly before someone said that rent control was ill-conceived and was suggesting that there were alternatives. And then there was a sort of brief list of alternative policies. And as someone who has lived in Berkeley for over 40 years in the same apartment, and an apartment that hasn't been as well maintained as it might have been, I have actually years of experience with this. And I want to say that I think that the difficult and problematic situation is, of course, housing and inflation, and especially housing inflation. But when the law changed, and forced Berkeley to allow vacancy decontrol, what that does is it just pulls the trigger on inflation again. So had there been a more strict rent control, then inflation of housing in Berkeley, at least, and of course that's not ideal either, would have been somewhat restrained. And I would not have been able to live here for this amount of time in North Berkeley, in a place that I love, in a building that, for all its imperfections and age, I love, without rent control. And the other options that were suggested sound both kind of undignified and grotesquely inadequate for addressing the housing challenge for people who need to rent. And I would certainly love to hear any response on the air. Thanks. I'll get off the phone.
Well, Michelle, thank you. I think the suggestion that was coming in was more along the lines of one way to do it, instead of putting the burden on the landlords that are holding it and having to deal with some of the costs, is maybe to give the landlord a subsidy or give you a subsidy directly that'll help you pay the rent, so that the burden is shared, but the state picks up more of it. But I'm going to take a – we've got a couple calls coming in. We're very tight on time. Last call, let's go to Dan in San Francisco. Dan was very quick. And I think we just lost Dan. Well, we're down to the last few minutes. It looks like there's one more call coming through, but I'd like to give each of you about a half a minute. If you'd like to have any closing thoughts, can I turn it to who would like to go first?
I'll go first. All right.
Okay, David, about a half a minute.
All right. As I said, most of my landlord clients are mom and pop kind of people. And my experience with them is the overwhelming majority, if not nearly all of them, are pretty fair in terms of they usually don't even think about taking the maximum increase that they're allowed even under the law, because they don't want turnovers. And turnovers mean they have to paint, and then the cost of painting, the cost of new carpeting, and changing the appliances and things like that would eat up years of the increase. So all they want is to keep their heads above water and not go negative in the property. So that's been, I mean, that's different than the big corporate landlords that are different. So what I'm saying is that that is two sides to a story, and I understand the retired school teacher and all of that, but they should listen to their retired mom and pops as well. That's all I have to say.
Who'd like to go next? Sal, you're nodding your head. You're up.
Okay. Yeah. No, I'd like to thank our listeners for participating in the program and the callers as well. We've had a few calls tonight where sort of passionate calls, about rent increases. And as David said, landlords are feeling the pinch as well. Landlords and tenants are going to ultimately have to figure this out themselves. And they may have to, swing a few times in order to get to a place where they can, finally talk about this and get someplace comfortable. But for the long run, it looks like rents are going to continue to increase, and tenants may have difficulty paying rent because of COVID. And even when COVID's over, they may still have lasting financial effects. So there is no fast answer to this. It's going to take time and patience, and nobody's happy. If I could just say one thing, nobody's happy. My clients that are landlords are not happy. My clients that are tenants are not happy. Nobody's happy. Everybody's suffering with this. I'll close with that.
Jessica, you got about 30 seconds.
Well, I just want to say thank you for having us here again this month, and also to the people who have been calling in. Yes, it's a very difficult and fraught topic, but there are ways. No one way is going to make it work. We're going to have to employ multiple attacks on this, and I think part of the legislature is part of it. I think local governments are part of it. Potentially, we can. I wish the federal government would expand some of its subsidy programs, like Section 8. But there are ways that we can get this to work, but we all have to work together toward the same goal and less antagonistically with each other.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights. We've been talking landlord-tenant law. Our guests tonight have been landlord-tenant attorneys extraordinaire Jessica Chilek and Salvador Timpano of San Francisco and David Finkelstein of San Mateo. Also joining me tonight is co-host, Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst Dean Johnson. Our final guest tonight has been all of you. Our show tonight's been produced by Dean Johnson and yours truly. Please be sure to join us, Your Legal Rights, again next week at 6 o'clock, where, as always, we'll take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guests, And back home at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe. Have a good night.
This is KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Montclair in Oakland.
Tiburon.
Sausalito.
Japantown, San Francisco.
Berkeley, California.